say I'm fascinated with death of late on this program. That is at least one message that we got for the show tonight. Not fascinated with death. Intrigued in learning more about what is inevitable. Really? I guess that's a way of looking at it, because inevitably, we all will die at one point in our lives. And as we sit back and we ponder, you know, that thought, which is really inevitable to all of us, some more imminent than others, we may never know what is ahead on any particular day for us. That's why we always are thankful for the day that we have lived, and we look forward to tomorrow, and we hope we're here at the end of tomorrow to do it all over again. At least that's how I look at it. At the end of the day, though, there are some of us whose souls go elsewhere. They end up kicking the bucket, and they end up departing to the other side, and their soul evolves. Now, the questions on how the soul evolves are very, very deep. And we hope to discuss many aspects of that tonight, actually, with my guest, Joshua Cutchin here, who is returning to the program after several years, author of the latest books, Ecology of Souls, which is a two-volume project. Volume 1 and 2 are out, A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal, where he takes a look at not only situations involving ordinary hauntings, but also bringing in UFOs and even altered states of consciousness and more into the conversation. So I'm glad to have him here. Hi, Joshua. Welcome back.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Why write a book about this particular subject?
Well, this particular subject had been sort of kicking around the back of my head for about 5 years, to be completely honest, when I got interested in this stuff pretty on. And there are always a couple of things that always sort of stuck in the back of my mind. The first of which was, you know, I've often found an affinity for the work of Jacques Vallée, especially his 1969 book Passport to Magonia, which illustrated a lot of connections between Western European fairy folklore and the UFO phenomenon. But I think in the background of that text, there's always sort of this unspoken connection that doesn't really get remarked on in that work, which is the fact that a lot of these cultures tended to think of the dead as being in close either communion with the with fairies, or tended to think of the dead perhaps being the fairies at the same time. So there was that, and there was also some correspondence that Anne Streber received in the wake of communion after her husband Whitley Streber published that book. And she had made some observations herself, and one of these things that she had made, one of these connections that she had made, was this has something to do with what we call death. Whitley's talked about this in several of his books, as him seeing her having written that in her handwriting and being really confronted by that idea. And, you know, as luck would have it, if you dig into this idea of UFOs somehow being connected to the dead, it's actually quite old in ufology. I mean, you can find stuff from the 1950s, right at the beginning of the modern, you know, flying saucer era, where they were sort of playing with a lot of these ideas. So this was an attempt to sort of bring all these different threads together in one place and say, does the UFO phenomenon have something to do with death? And, you know, it's a hard sell because a lot of people are convinced that the UFO phenomenon is extraterrestrial. But I think the jury's still out on that.
Well, do you mind sharing more about some of those early examples that you just mentioned with us?
Yeah, so there are some early discussions. You'll find a lot of these in Flying Saucer Review. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that publication, but it was a British magazine that was being published overseas and was actually quite open to talking about a lot of these different ideas. But there are also some older things, some quotes that some people have talked about where they were, you know, sort of playing with the idea of what if this is somehow technology that's being made from the other side of the veil. And that sounds like an odd idea for a lot of us in the modern era, right? Like the idea that like the afterlife would have its own technological development and would continue to progress, but it would not at all be a foreign idea to someone in, say, ancient Egypt. I mean, in ancient Egypt, the idea was that once you died, you wake up in the Tuat and you have to farm your fields and you have to continue worship and you eat and you sleep and you, you know, all these day-to-day lives. And so there was the potential for the world on the other side of the veil to continue to progress in its technology. And you can find those little bits here and there in some of those older publications.
Very interesting what you just said there. So let's dig, you know, kind of deeper in there. What really is, I guess, the connection between this all? Can you sum it up for us?
Well, you know, my editor, Barbara Fisher, who runs the Six Degrees of John Keel podcast, she sort of confronted me afterwards and was like, well, you say it's all about death, but it really isn't all about death, Josh. It's about the cyclicality of existence. And I would agree with that. I mean, it really should be, you know, a new mythology of death, life, and the paranormal. But death is sort of the foot in the door. But what I started to notice was that, you know, I really approached this just wanting to look at UFOs and death, and the amount of baggage that you've got to unpack from that simple idea just tends to continue to snowball and multiply in a lot of ways. Because, you know, you have to talk about near-death experiences, and, you know, anybody who's been involved in ufology for a while knows about the work of Kenneth Ring, who made some very clear connections between the near-death experience and the alien abduction experience as we know it today, in his work, the Omega Project, and some of his other stuff. And at the same time, you know, you have folks like Eddie Bullard, ufologist, who at the time he compiled this book that was sort of like the go-to book for alien abductions, called I believe it was called Alien Abductions: Measure of a Mystery. And that's a 2-volume work. And he made a lot of comparisons between the sort of shamanic initiations that you'd see in a lot of indigenous cultures and the UFO experience. And of course, shamanic initiations in a lot of these cultures are, you know, de facto rebirth ceremonies that you either symbolically or in some cases, you know, literally are brought to or beyond the point of death. And you're reborn as a magical practitioner in your tribe who's able to commune with the spirit world. So you've got the fairy thing, you've got the near death thing, you've got the shamanic thing, you've got the UFO thing. It all sort of starts to point in the same direction of death. And as you know, I'm completely open to the idea that I sort of ended up with confirmation bias after a certain point, but it was striking to see how you could carry this thread on into things like cryptids and, you know, even some of these ancient monuments that we like to talk about that seem to have some sort of affinity with UFO phenomenon. They too also speak to some very deep and fundamental connections to the way that we've always perceived that transition from life into death.
I mean, when we think about, you know, hauntings, the death process makes sense because it is believed that these beings that we are interacting with are deceased, people who lived and are deceased, and this is their spirit. Some of the other phenomena, say the Bigfoot phenomena, the death concept, I don't think is as widely talked about. Is the belief that the Bigfoot is then not a living and breathing species, or what?
Well, you know, an idea that I'm fond of, I'm not sure how much credence I give to it, but an idea that I'm fond of is that things like the Loch Ness Monster are plesiosaur ghosts, and that Bigfoot is perhaps some sort of ancient hominid ghost, right? You know, and I really don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because it seems almost a little bit too simplistic. But at the same time, if you look at, you know, a lot of the newspaper reports around the early 20th century and late 19th century, especially in America, you know, they very rarely would they sometimes refer to these things as apes or ape men, but it was very common to see the term hairy ghost employed and discussed time and again, because they were trying to encompass some of the high strangeness that they were seeing at the time. And of course, as you know, I've written a lot about high strangeness and Bigfoot with Timothy Renner, Where the Footprints End, our 2-volume work on that. So you've got that, you've got the belief that, you know, sometimes among some of these tribes, that these things were the returned spirits of the dead, or the returned spirits of shamans who had been corrupted and had come back as hairy cannibal giants themselves. So there's always, almost always, a connection there.
And one of those connections that is just absolutely mind-blowing that you discuss is that in which spirits of the dead are actually haunting the living, and in some cases, appearing during what, alien abductions?
Yeah, that's the other thing that's always bothered me, because, I mean, I think people look at my work and they want to say that I'm just being, you know, unorthodox for the sake of it. And the truth of the matter is, like, I want Bigfoot to be a big hairy monkey, and I want UFOs to be extraterrestrials, right? But I just am trying to follow the data where it leads. And there is no shortage of people who are, you know, UFO experiencers who claim that either directly on board the quote unquote craft or during times of heavy UFO activity, they've encountered dead loved ones. And sometimes even people that they didn't know were dead until they confirmed it later after having met them in that context. So, like, what do you do with that? Like, if it's extraterrestrials, they're really weird extraterrestrials. But once you take a step back and you start to look at some of the motifs that are associated with the UFO phenomenon, it starts to make a little bit more sense. At least it does to me. I mean, the UFO phenomenon is obsessed with transportation, right? Like, all the questions around UFOs revolve around place, right? Like, where do they come from? Why are they here? You know, it's that sort of thing. How do they get here? And if you look at some of these ancient cosmologies, and the way that you would often reach the afterlife is by some sort of, you know, mode of transportation, typically, you know, a ship, and sometimes the ship would have the ability to traverse the stars. And my contention is that, you know, when you have a culture that's as globalized as we are, and basically every corner of the map has been cataloged and, you know, detailed, what happens to that mythological other world, that mythological afterlife that we often thought was just over the horizon or just beyond that mountain range? What do we do with that? I would argue that we probably transpose that to the stars. And then you start to look at some of the other symbolism. You know, I don't know how familiar you are with the work of Mike Cleland, but he's talked about, you know, the appearance of owls.
Oh, the owls, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Conjunction with, yeah. And then you start looking at, so you start looking at sort of the animals and the motifs that are associated with the UFO thing, and they're often these death motifs. Specifically, they're often psychopomps, which is a term that not a lot of people know, but everybody's familiar with the concept. These are things like the Grim Reaper or Anubis or Hermes, these sort of deities and folk deities that would be charged with carrying you across that transition. And then once you start playing with that, you can kind of see how these same ideas show up time and again. I mean, psychopomps were often tricksters, and a lot's been talked about, you know, the UFO phenomenon being sort of tricksterish phenomenon. But even beyond that, every culture had a certain set of animals that they treated as psychopomps. Those were horses, dogs, and birds. And a lot of times they were, guess what, owls. So at least on a symbolic level, it starts to make a good deal of sense, again, for me, when viewed through this perspective.
And one of the questions that you propose in the book is whether or not the UFO mystery is reaching out from beyond the stars or from beyond the grave, which is a fascinating thought that, you know, we believe, at least the leading theory is that it's extraterrestrials from outer space who are behind it. But I guess in all reality, it could be humans who are dead.
Well, yeah, and you know, I know that a lot of people will say, well, you know, they tell us they come from this place or that, or they tell us about their technology, or, you know, this firsthand exchange of information between experiencers and these entities. But if you look back through your parapsychological literature, you'll find lots of allusions to the fact that, you know, spirits, for lack of a better term, are always kind of liars. That's something that Emanuel Swedenborg, you know, one of the most important figures to spiritualism, said, you know, whatever you hear, just don't believe what they say. So, and I'm not necessarily talking about spirits in this, like, sort of reductive Judeo-Christian, always good versus evil kind of spirits, but more of, you know, as the book title alludes to, an ecology of souls, you know, things that have your best interest in mind and things that don't have your best interest in mind and things that could not care, like, you know, like we would think of sharks in the ocean ecosystem. The shark isn't evil. It just doesn't care about you and is looking out for its own needs.
Absolutely. Shark first attitude. As far as death, do you think that really this plays a bigger role in the paranormal, in the supernatural, than it is really perceived?
I mean, I would have to say so. The thing that I keep coming back to with this book, which is something that, again, I've been wanting to get off my chest for a long time. And if I hadn't written this book, I would regret it. And honestly, I could probably walk away from the paranormal now feeling like I'd said my piece, because this idea has been stuck with me for so long. And the thing that I keep coming back to is that this works for me and it allows me to incorporate some outliers. But You know, I suspect that part of it is due to the fact that one of the most important forces in the universe, if not death specifically itself, is entropy. I mean, everything succumbs to entropy. Everything's in the process of breaking down and degrading. So the idea that it would have something to do with that doesn't really surprise me. I'm not trying to form a new religion around UFOs or anything, but it seems like there might be some mechanisms regarding that transition from this world into another world that we don't quite have a good grasp on. And interestingly enough, you know, I am a Christian myself. I keep most of my, you know, Christianity out of the text until the afterward. You know, it's interesting if you look at like sort of our concepts of heaven and to a degree hell as well, there's not as much of a scriptural basis for exactly what that looks like as we've been led to believe. Like a lot of the things that we think of when we think of heaven are basically Christian fan fiction from Chaucer and Dante. So there's a lot of questions that still exist regarding the mechanisms and the specifics of whatever this transition in might entail and whatever that place might be. You know, I mean, it's something that, you know, more fashionable ideas nowadays, like simulation theory, are kind of playing with in and of themselves. The idea that, you know, you die and you wake up and you're someplace else entirely. And this has been all, you know, some sort of video game, basically.
How did you come to this, this possibility? And I'm wondering if the similarity or maybe the commonality of some of these different paranormal events played a part in that, because it certainly does appear when you hear stories of people, sometimes it seems like they are describing the same thing, but they all view it a little differently, or at least they label it a little differently.
Yeah, I've become something of a pan paranormalist over the years. And I do think that what I'm fond of saying is that if it's not a complete circle, the Venn diagrams of these different topics definitely overlap quite a good deal. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is go through these different contact modalities, not only the, you know, shamanic stuff and the near-death stuff and the UFO stuff, but also, you know, altered states of consciousness, like the, you know, psychedelic trips and stuff like that. Also some cryptid encounters. All of them seem to have this, a lot of the same shared suite of attributes. Like a lot of them will begin with an intense buzzing sound. Not always, I'm not saying that, but a lot of them will begin with an intense buzzing sound. You've got this light phenomena that is, you know, associated with all these different categories. A sense of amnesia afterwards, sometimes missing time. Like there's missing time in Bigfoot reports, which just boggles my mind. But I think that a lot of these things are connected. And for me, it was always that bit about the dead showing up in UFO abductions. And then you take that one step further, and something that I always had a hard time grappling with, because I just literally was biased and didn't like the idea, were these tales of reincarnation with UFO experiencers, these tales of pre-birth agreements between people and the ETs. Like, I don't get those out of my ufology. Like, I don't want that there. But at the same time, like, I had to be intellectually honest with myself and say, these stories aren't going away, and they're still here, and they're still going to keep on being told. So I either have to find a way to incorporate them and make some sense of them, or throw them out. And I'm not a big fan of throwing out an entire category of eyewitness testimony just because it doesn't agree with my own biases.
In these altered states of consciousness, people have reported a variety of beings, and who knows, those could be beings that have departed.
Yeah, that's something that I sort of found early on, is that like you don't see a lot of these things that you don't see like missing time in ghost stories that much, right? Like you see things that look like time slips, but you don't see that sort of like, you know, time dilation or time compression, or just the sense that, you know, you've lost a couple of hours. And I suspect that's, you know, you don't see it in every UFO sighting. You don't see it in every cryptid sighting by any stretch of the imagination. And I've kind of speculated that if you have missing time, that means that a part of you went somewhere. Maybe your consciousness went somewhere or something. But if you don't have missing time, it's because a part of them came over here, right? So I often joke about, a bunch of sophomore Sasquatch in their college dorm room taking whatever their equivalent of DMT is and popping up on this side of the veil, because they often look surprised. Like these creatures, UFO occupants, Bigfoot, whatever you want to say, they often look surprised when they see people, like, oh, I didn't know you were going to be here.
Yeah. What a buzz. You mentioned missing time. Do you think that phenomena then is just exclusive to the UFO and the ET phenomena?
No, you see it in a lot of places. You know, it's something that you see a lot of times. I mean, obviously it's prefigured in the fairy folklore, right? Where people would think that they were away for a day and they were away for a generation, you know, in our time. But you also see it in near-death experiences. There's often, to the inverse, a sensation that people are there for a very long time in that NDE realm, and then they're revived and it's been like 10 minutes or something. They're like, I thought I was there for days. It's not as strongly figured in the shamanic initiations, although it is to a certain degree. Definitely a part of, you know, the altered states of consciousness, definitely a part of the UFO experience. But yeah, it happens in some cryptid encounters, and that's what really sort of boggled my mind. My favorite example is Wes Germer, who hosts the Sasquatch Chronicles podcast, had a very harrowing encounter with his brother in Washington, and they were basically, their car was circled by these Bigfoot for a while, and they came. And it was so funny. I remember way back when, like this was years ago, he's talking in his interview, and he's like, there's just one thing I can't figure out. He says, you know, I felt like we should have been up there for 40 minutes tops, and we came back down the mountain, and the clock read 4 hours later. And I'm like, oh boy, that's missing time. And you can find that. You can find that if you look for it. It's not at all unheard of. And then, you know, you add into that some of these things like where people will, you know, repress these memories of Bigfoot encounters for years, which is another hallmark of all these different contact modalities. And, you know, that might be literally repressed memory as a defensive mechanism, although from a psychological standpoint, that's a very controversial topic. But it also seems like maybe there's some sort of mechanism about the experience that sort of forces it down into your subconscious until it's triggered later, you know.
Do you think that, you know, conventional science would be open to some of these possibilities?
I mean, no, but I also don't really care if they are or not.
Good for you.
This has been sort of my thing that I've been hammering on about, you know, with the disclosure movement, is everybody's, you know, clamoring for disclosure. The idea that an authority structure is going to hand the keys to the UFO kingdom down to everyone. And I don't think you need that. I don't think that's really what disclosure is. I think, you know, this is going to sound like a Hallmark card, but I think the disclosure really does come from within. Like, you don't have to be told or given permission to believe in these things or think that these things exist. You just have to surpass a critical threshold in your own thinking that makes you say, hey, it seems like there's something to this that is genuinely anomalous. And then from there, you know, congratulations, you've got your disclosure. So, you know, I think that basically at the end of the day, I suppose this is sort of a spiritual text because it's talking a lot about these ancient ideas of the soul that we've forgotten and how they're reflected in these modern encounters. And I think that if you get too much science in your spirituality or too much spirituality in your science, it's always a little bit of an underwhelming outcome.
Did you find a pattern or at least a selection of some reports of UFO and alien encounters that seem to have happened near cemeteries and graveyards?
100%. So Scott Corrales, who's a UFO researcher, he runs, I believe it's the Inexplicada blog, has cataloged this extensively. And so I have three appendices. The book was so big that I had to split it in two. And some people, if they're looking for it, will also see The Ecology of Souls Companion. That's just a physical copy of a PDF that you can get online at my website. And it's just the references and, you know, the end notes, the bibliography, and three appendices. And again, that's all, you know, if people get the book, you can still access that for free. You don't have to have the physical copy unless you just love physical books. But I have three appendices, one of the dead who were known, to the experiencer, so like a dead loved one, a dead friend. The second one is the dead who appear in UFO scenarios who were unknown to the person at the time and either discovered that or were told by these people that they were dead. But also the third appendix is just UFOs seen above cemeteries and graveyards. And, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that we're more contemplative when we're in those burial spaces. But at the same time, it seems a little bit too frequent to be completely coincidental in my book. But who knows?
Interesting. And the thoughts as well that people may have encounters with people who are known but also unknown to them. Because you would view those each differently, I'm imagining.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting, and what you tend to see is that people tend to know the people that they experience, or the people that they see rather, these experiences. But there was one case that I really did love of a woman who was in Massachusetts. This was around 1963, and she had a very sort of contactee style alien abduction with these gray aliens. But at one point she was in, I believe, this sort of auditorium, and she met this woman who identified herself as Ingrid Swinson, and she didn't know who it was. And, you know, obviously she comes out of this experience and she talks to UFO, UFO researchers, and she provides this name. And as it turns out, there is an Ingrid Swinson in South Dakota who had just died. So, you know, it was the 60s. We didn't have quite a lock on tracking people down like we do today. But at the same time, it's an interesting little coincidence that maybe she met this person who had just died after she was aboard a UFO and didn't realize that she was dead until she got some independent confirmation.
Joshua, appreciate you coming on board the program tonight and sharing with us some really fascinating thoughts. Thanks so much.
Oh, it's absolutely a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And your website, tell folks where they can pick up your other books as well, and about your other books, because you also write about some other very interesting subjects. I think you have one called, Thieves in the Night?
Mm-hmm, yep. So I have, depending on the way you count it, about 7 books. A Trojan Feast, which is about the food and drink exchanges in these encounters. The Brimstone Deceit, which is all about smells and all sorts of encounters, UFO encounters, cryptid encounters, etc. Thieves in the Night, which is all about supernatural child abduction. The 2-part series, Where the Footprints End, with Timothy Renner, which is all about high strangeness in Bigfoot. So sort of your one-stop shop for the really weird Bigfoot stories. And then Ecology of Souls, A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal, Volumes 1 and 2. That's either available directly through me in signed copies. I also do a discount bundle for people who buy 2 of them together. Or you can just go to Amazon. And it's the combined volumes are available as 1 ebook as well. My website is joshuacutchin.com, JOSHUACUTCHIN.com. Just like a cut on your chin.
I appreciate that. And if anybody knows anything about me, they know I'm always looking for ways to describe things as a whole, because I very much believe that there are more of this is connected than is not connected. Would you agree with that statement, Joshua?
I would. And my greatest hope for this would be that someday the idea that we are looking at, the Ecology of Souls model, would someday stand alongside ideas like the ultraterrestrial hypothesis and, you know, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, all these sort of other different ideas that have happened through the years. I'd like to see some people at least seriously entertain the possibility that it could have to do with this final transition that we all face.
All right, Joshua's website is joshuacutchin.com, author of the 2-part Ecology of Souls, A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal. Thanks so much for coming on the program. Appreciate it.
An absolute pleasure. Thanks so much. Have a nice night.
You too as well. And we'll be back on Saturday night for you, friends, with the 2-hour show before we move to Wednesdays next week. I know we're going to confuse the heck out of a lot of you, but try to keep up over at ParanormalRadio.com or on Facebook and our Twitter page. We do a fairly good job, we believe, of at least giving you advance notice when those upcoming episodes are. From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, I'm Jeremy Scott. Good night, and God bless.